This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Good morning, everyone. This is our first morning with the windows open. I hope you guys at home can feel the breeze. It's pretty nice. This is from a collection of short sutras from the Samyutta Nikaya collection, the connected sutras of the Buddha. And there are a series of short sutras in which Mara comes to visit a number of the Buddha's female disciples. And this is the Sila Sutta. Abiding in Savati. In the morning, the bhikkhuni Sila dressed into her robes, and she went down and sat at the foot of a tree for the day's abiding, the day's meditation. And then Mara, the evil one, desiring to arouse fear and trepidation and terror in the bhikkhuni Sila, desiring to make her fall away from her concentration, approached her and addressed her in this way. By whom has this puppet been created? Where is the maker of the puppet? Where is the puppet arisen, and where does it cease? And then it occurred to the bhikkhuni Sila, now who is this? This must be Mara, the evil one, desiring to make me fall away from my concentration. And then having understood this, she said, this is Mara, the evil one. This puppet is not made by itself, nor is this made by another. It has come to be dependent on a cause. When the cause ceases, then it will cease. Just as when a seed is sown in a field, it grows depending on a pair of factors. It requires the soil's nutrients and a steady supply of moisture. Just so the aggregates and elements and the six bases of sensory contact have come to be dependent on a cause. And when the cause dissolves, they will cease. And then Mara, realizing the bhikkhuni Sila knows me, was sad and disappointed and disappeared right there. So this monastic bhikkhuni Sila obviously lived in the time of the Buddha. She was born in a kingdom called Alavi, and she was the king's daughter. And one day she went with her father, the king, to hear the Buddha teach. And she was young and had no commitments at that point. She was married, had no children. And right there, she had great faith in the Buddha's teaching upon hearing him and meeting him, and became a disciple, asked to become a lay disciple of the Buddha's. And within days after that, she asked to receive ordination. And so she received ordination and immediately began to receive instruction. And it said that she consequently saw through the complexities of thoughts, words, and actions and was enlightened, became enlightened. And so she lived, continued to live and study with the Buddha. And it was during that time when she was living her life, practicing the way, that she encountered Mara. Mara is in Buddhism often referred to his epithet as the evil one. So he represents the embodiment of all that is obstructive, of harmful, of all that is negating of life. And he appears in many different ways. He appears in the sutras. He appears in the series of sutras to some of the female disciples of the Buddha. He first came, and he's considered to be a powerful deity and that his sort of his mission is to prevent people from liberation. That's his role. And but he has power. He's powerful. And he first came to the Buddha when the Buddha was sitting on the night of his enlightenment, and he came to the Buddha to try and dissuade him from achieving liberation. And he did that in a whole number of ways. He sent armies to destroy him, and it's said that the Buddha transformed the weapons of these armies into flowers. He sent all kinds of enticements and doubts and all kinds of, all sorts of strategies that he could call upon to try and dissuade the Buddha from achieving liberation. I think of this often as Mara's attempts to just have the Buddha walk away from himself, from his aspiration. And as the Buddha grew very close to his enlightenment, Mara asked him, by what right do you sit here under this Bodhi tree seeking liberation? And the Buddha said, by right of all of the lives that he had lived, the innumerable lives and all of the good works that he had done and the merit he'd accumulated as a bodhisattva during all of those countless eons. And when Mara said, who can vouch for this claim of yours? The Buddha famously reached down and touched the earth and invoked the goddess of the earth. And she attested to his claim by making the earth shake. Soon after the Buddha's enlightenment, Mara came to the Buddha again. And this is before he began teaching. He was still at what we now call Bodh Gaya. And he urged the Buddha to just go directly into Parinirvana. In other words, to end his life, leave his body, be free of this burdensome body, and enter into Parinirvana, to not worry about teaching, but just to go ahead and, in a sense, claim his complete enlightenment in Parinirvana. And the Buddha said that he would do so. He would do so. So in a sense, he gave Mara a promise. He said, now's not the time. I won't do it now, but I will do it when there are monastics and lay practitioners who have studied and who understand the teachings and have experienced the fruit of the teachings, that they have matured themselves, that within the Sangha teachers have appeared, and that students are studying with those teachers, and that they are living their enlightenment. And when this Dharma has been well established within the population, he said, then I will leave. And so towards the end of the Buddha's life in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, Mara comes to claim his promise, the Buddha's promise. And so he comes to the Buddha and says, it's time. And the Buddha, it's very interesting, it's kind of fascinating sutra. And it's got many different parts to it. It's quite long. And the Buddha, in speaking with Ananda, who was, of course, the Buddha's faithful attendant, the Buddha several times makes clear that a Buddha can live for an eon, but they must be requested to do so. And Ananda doesn't make that request. And finally, the Buddha lets Ananda know that he has just prior, moments before, had a conversation with Mara in which he has told Mara, okay, I will enter Parinirvana in several months' time. So our deal is soon to be completed. And he lets Ananda know this. And of course, Ananda now is distressed that his teacher is going to be ending his life soon. And so he asks him to live on for an eon. And the Buddha basically says it's too late. He said, I gave you several opportunities to do this. And he actually recounts a number of opportunities going back into previous, you know, time, where the Buddha told Ananda this, and Ananda never asked him. And so now Ananda is asking him repeatedly, and the Buddha says, it's too late. I can't do it now. I've already told Mara that I will enter Parinirvana. So it's interesting, there's a lot to me that's very fascinating about this, but it's interesting that Mara, in these early teachings, is a force that cannot be ignored. You know, you think the Buddha would have just vanquished and just said, get out of here. You have no power. I have nothing to say to you. We have nothing to talk about. But that he actually, Mara is a force that can't just be ignored, but that can be, in a sense, worked with skillfully, and within one's own discernment, we might say. And so this caused no small trouble for Ananda when the Sangha found out that he had not asked the Buddha to live on for an eon. He has some explaining to do. And then when I was doing some research, one scholar said that the reason he didn't ask the Buddha to live on for an eon is because in that very moment, Mara was distracting him. We all know the possibility of that. So here, Sila, this bhikkhuni, is meditating, is practicing, and Mara wants to do what he's supposed to do, which is to upseat her, to turn her away from her meditation, to get in the way of her practice. By whom has this puppet been created? Where is the maker of the puppet? This puppet, and she responds, this puppet is not made by itself, nor is it made by another. It has come to be dependent on a cause, and when the cause dissolves, then it will cease. And so this image of a puppet on a string. There are several koans, actually, that involve puppets. Linji had a koan in the miscellaneous about a puppet. And who is drawing those strings? And it's an image, I think, that many of us can relate to. It's being held up and, in a sense, being manipulated. And who's holding the strings? All those times when we feel like we're not fully in control, not able to do what we want to do, what we think we need to do or should do, and somehow are unable to do that, not able to respond fully or in the ways that we aspire to. In the many moments of the day, we watch our life pass by. We see opportunities coming and going. We're unable to stop time. We seem not able to master it. How does this come to be? For those who have faith in God as a creator, that might answer some of those questions. It might also raise questions, almost certainly. The Buddha in his enlightenment saw into innumerable lifetimes, his lifetimes, going back and back and back and back and back and back. And he also saw into the lifetimes of others, he said, and into, in particular, into the karma of their actions, how they lived their life, the choices they made, the actions they took, and the consequences of those actions. And so that he really saw profoundly into the nature of cause and effect, and how those are always established within certain conditions, that no action takes place in a void. It's always contextual. And conditions here means as body and mind, or senses of organs of consciousness and sense, how we perceive things, but also are the conditions of our life, the conditions we're in at that moment, and so on. He saw how being led by desires, this leads us to attachments based in a sense of lack, based in a sense of a self separate from the universe. And it's in this way that this body and mind, nama rupa, this karmic body, comes into being. That this physical form is dependent upon actions. It doesn't just happen by itself. It is not made by itself. It does not act by itself. It does not act upon itself for itself. It does not bring itself into being in this life or in each moment. It doesn't act alone. And the very question of what is it, what is this puppet, of course, is the essential question. But it is not made by another either. There is no other outside that is acting upon the puppet, upon us, determining, creating our fate, knowing our destiny. These are things that the Buddha said do not exist in this universe. There is no it, no puppet that can be found within the wooden arms and legs, within the strings. Nor is there a puppet or a person that exists apart from the wooden legs and arms, from the aggregates. This being that we call ourself and all of our actions always exist within conditions. And it has come to be dependent within those conditions upon our actions. And when those actions dissolve, then the person, the sense of person, the puppet, ceases to be. It no longer appears in the old way. And sometimes people ask, why would I want this to cease? Why would I want to not go on and on and on as long as possible? In the Metta Sutta we chant, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. And this speaks about the traditional understanding of Buddhism in rebirth, that in Parinirvana the Buddha would not be returning for another lifetime, as he had for incalculable eons in the past. He had broken that cycle. We can also understand this, and Buddhism also understands this, as moment to moment, not being born again into this world in the old way. Not being born in the way that we think being born is. And so she draws the parallel with a seed being planted carefully in the soil, or sometimes not so carefully, and that it requires conditions and actions for that seed to sprout and to come into its full maturity. So it needs moisture and soil and nutrients and sunlight and warmth. And so too for the puppet, so too for the person, so too for everything that exists. And so the aggregates, the skandhas, she says, just so the aggregates and elements in these six bases of sensory contact. So form, sensation, our perceptions, the way we discriminate and begin to name and understand and remember and make associations, which gives rise to desires and actions and consciousness, a sense of someone. And the elements here relate to the conditions of our eyes and ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, to the objects we perceive, to our consciousness which perceives. We can think of those conditions as for life as being an egg and a sperm and a womb and love and protection and guidance. And how all of those work together. Nothing can come into being without these causes and conditions. And so I've been thinking about this in terms of, really thinking about this in terms of systems, which is a field of study, systems theory, systems thinking, really looking at how do things work. Wherever you look, whatever we see happening, whatever environment we're talking about, whether it's a person, whether it's a biological person, whether it's an ecosystem, whether it's a business, government, whether it's a practitioner. And so within these systems are hierarchies. And I said that I wanted to speak about this because this is a word as we are working to liberate us, ourselves, and others from all of the many forms of oppression and aggression and violence and hatred and greed and confusion, all of the poisons, that often hierarchy is invoked as a sort of an essential part of the of those sort of malevolent forces. And so it usually carries a sense, is invoked with the sense of having some sort of negative, harmful qualities, as though it's inherent within hierarchies. And there's reasons for that, because we see the ways in which people and structures do misuse power, do control, do dominate, do hurt, do bring forth aggression and violence. In the Oxford Dictionary, hierarchy is described as a system in which grades or classes of status or authority are ranked one above the other. And so right there we can see, and it seems to be inherent and in that, inherent in that definition, that already there is dominant and subordinate. But if we examine more closely, is that true? Is that what is meant here? And interestingly, in its roots are in Christian theology, where within the world of angels, there are divisions of angels, ranks of angels, and that hierarchy, its earliest meaning had to do with those different ranks of angels in the celestial order, and then that was sort of transferred over into priestly and religious institutions and then on into other kinds of social issue systems. So the question is hierarchy itself the problem, or is there something working within hierarchy? So hierarchy is basically just groups or classes within a system. So what is a system? And this, of course, is very conceptual, right? But I think it's interesting in our as we try to understand the inner workings of ourself. I mean, that's really what Buddha Dharma is looking at the deepest level of this puppet, of this person, that which we call ourself. The Buddha said, if we don't understand that, he framed it often in terms of understanding causes and conditions, that unless we understand that, see into that clearly, we can't really practice effectively. We can't really come to liberation. But if we look at that more broadly, and if we use other ways of looking at this, and see how different language can affirm and give us different kinds of insight, I think it would be very powerful. And so is hierarchy itself the problem, or is there something going on within these system structures that are causing the harm? So I've been studying a book by Donella Meadows, who's a pretty well-known systems thinker. And she said, a system is just a set of things, people, cells, objects, whatever. The key, though, is that they're connected. And they're connected in such a way that they begin to produce their own pattern of behavior. So that's the key. It's just a collection of things, but that they're connected in such a way that they begin to produce their own behavior that is unique or distinct to that system, that cluster of objects. And that system, that cluster of things, can be influenced, buffeted, constricted, triggered, driven by outside forces. But the way that that system, that group of things, responds is characteristic of itself. And that's very important. In other words, it develops habits, patterns of behavior that are unique to that system itself. And she says, and that response, those responses are seldom simple in the actual world. They're complex. And in looking at this within, and looking at hierarchies and more contemporary ways of thinking, and particularly through this systems thinking, I read it on Thursday night in the Ecodharma study from John Gerber, who's a systems thinker in terms of biology, botany, and agriculture. And he said, while it's true that humans have had thousands of years of experience organizing as power over hierarchies, so that's one way of looking at sort of that sense of hierarchy that we don't want, we bristle at, which is basically power over, dominating, controlling. He says, well, there's thousands of years of human history demonstrating that. Ecological systems have for several billions of years been having experience operating as power with hierarchies. That is, rather than power being manifested as commanding and controlling over other groups within that system, right? The hierarchy being a collection of systems, it is seen as participation and conclusion and inclusion. And so he said, today we understand a natural hierarchy. A hierarchy that can, I think, exist naturally as in nature, but also can exist naturally, I would say, in the sense of it being in accord with who we are and the way things actually work. He said, we can see these as a nested set of systems within systems in which there is increasing complexity. So if you think of a system as just a collection of objects, then a hierarchy is just a gathering of different systems that are nested together, which is kind of a nice way of thinking about it, right? They're not opposing each other, they're not competing or trying to dominate each other, they're nested together. He says an organism like you and me contains lower or less complex subsystems like the human heart and are likewise contained within the larger, more complex subsystem of the world, a community, a nation, a people. So we can think of the mountains and rivers order as systems of residence, could be thought of as a system of students, of the larger Sangha, Chakai students, monastics, and that being nested within the larger community of Buddhists, of Buddhist practitioners, which is nested within the larger community of humanity, which is nested within the larger community of, and on it goes. And he said, one of the most important lessons that can teach us has to do with the relationship between these levels of complexity. How do these different systems, these different groupings, relate to each other in such a way that the patterns of behavior that they begin to produce reinforce the goodness of that system. We might say the purpose. If we think of this as a practitioner, that we have these various systems within ourselves, biological, emotional, dharmic, aspirational, and that with all of, and within each of those, you can look into them and see sort of clusters of things, of thoughts, of emotions, of histories, and that those work together in our person and begin to create patterns of behavior. And that in a control over kind, so if you think of ourselves as a kind of hierarchy, that can be a control over where we try and control and dominate and force something to happen, which never goes well. Or that we can be power with, that we, it's a nested, that we're working together within ourselves. Isn't that exactly what we're trying to develop in practice? And so if we think of what are the negative forces within these hierarchies that cause the power over, that cause the harm, the suffering, then we can think of those systems as patriarchy, male dominance, of white supremacy, of dominance and control and sort of forcefulness, aggression based on heterosexuality or being cisgendered. Or I think of Christianism, an ism within our culture, as being not ultimately about Christianity itself, but being part of a system that is a dominating force within our culture. Youth, being able-bodied, that these get graded and classified in such a way and ranked that they seem to take on an absolute quality. One is better than another. That's not what the definition actually said. Above, we just immediately assume, means better than. But in this way of thinking, I believe what it means is more complex. That there are some systems, some collections that are more simple, more bare. Maybe their function is more simple. And that as those are nested together, they form more and more complex. They have more and more complex functions. Right. So we could think of delusion. So Donella Meadows says that one of the most marvelous characteristics of complex systems is their ability to learn, to diversify, to complexify, and to evolve. And this capacity of a system to make its own structure more complex. And complex here doesn't mean, you know, entangled and, you know, gnarled and stuck. It means more powerful, in a sense. And the ability for a system to make its own structure more complex is called self-organization. And she says that ability to become more complex, in a sense, is what we're trying to do through practice. In a sense, by becoming more and more simple, by simplifying the sort of diluted complexities we've created, which are systems that have their own pattern of behavior, right? By stripping down, stripping down, stripping down, letting go, letting go, letting go. Because delusion, while it appears very complex and the problems it creates can be very complicated, and that the habit patterns that we have in our mind and consciousness can be seem very complicated, what delusion itself is trying to do is to go in exactly the opposite direction of being self-organizing. It is not trying to learn. It's sort of antithetical to learning. It's antithetical to diversity. It's opposed to complexity and to evolution. What it wants to do is to maintain a rigid, static state of being, which it perceives as being safe. And that it has to and tries to construe as a path and a state of happiness, a path to and a state of happiness. Of course, that doesn't work out very well either. And so if we think about delusion and sort of manifestations of delusion in terms of slogans, right? How a slogan reduces, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of history of human society and interactions and thought and philosophy and to just a few words. How it breeds righteousness, an absolute sense of what is right and wrong. I am right and you are wrong. We have nothing to talk about. I'm not interested in your opinion because your opinion's wrong. And the intolerance, the impatience that breeds, that it says requires, that it requires so that it can avoid rationally having to allow the complexity of history and humanity and consciousness, these systems. Because if we acknowledge them, then we have to deal with it. If we acknowledge it, then we have to acknowledge it within ourselves, and we have to meet it. And so delusion is designed to avoid all of that. I mean, just think of the examples abound. And think of world leaders who have tried to who have tried to see the world and engage their leadership within that complexity, there's very little tolerance for that, right? They are branded as weak, afraid to take action, indecisive. And so training and practice is helping us to cultivate this ability to move into learning, complexity, diversity, and evolution. And so if we think of that in terms of, just learning, right understanding, developing our understanding, examining, reflecting, paying attention, and diversity is our ability to hold everything. You are vast and contain the multitude. That in one moment you can hold your aspiration for liberation and your apathy. You can hold your ability to be diligent and lazy. You can hold your anger towards someone and your love for them. Right? And just think about how hard that is to do, right? And the impulse to want to just seek, no, it's just this. If I just hold on to this, then I know what it's about. I know what to do. And to hold all of that does what? It demands more. It calls on us. We have to learn. We have to become more complex. We have to be able to see and engage in the complexity. We have to evolve. Donella Meadows says, self-organization, this ability to be this alive, this powerful, this is part of our spiritual power. She says it produces heterogeneity, which is diversity, and unpredictability. This can then come up with new ways of doing things. That's our evolution, right? We don't have to go down the same road over and over and over again. We don't have to follow that pattern. And so we don't just know that we don't have to, but we actually don't. We come up with new ways of doing things. In a sense, practice from the very beginning is essentially you met at the door and it's like, here, try this. Here's a new way of doing something. Here's a new way of being in your mind. Here's a new way of being in your body. Here's a new way of meeting all that is getting ready to come, right? About which you have no idea. Right? None of us have any idea. We have lots of ideas. Right? Some of them are right. And then she says, in order to do this, this requires freedom and experimentation and a certain amount of disorder. Right? A revolution is underway. It requires the freedom to continually step back in, to try another way, to experiment. The Buddha is not a fixed rule. Dharma practice is not a fixed rule. Zazen is not a fixed rule. Within, the ways in which we train, that can seem like, okay, we're doing this, we're doing kenin, we're doing meditation, we're doing liturgy this way. But within that, this self-organizing creature, you, must find your freedom and be experimenting to engage that very practice, right? Because when somebody gives you the instruction in meditation, you're not meditating yet. And she says, those very conditions of freedom, experimentation, and a certain amount of disorder are the conditions that encourage learning, diversifying, greater complexity, and evolution. And she says, this will often be scary for individuals and will appear threatening to power structures. This power structure of the self, a power structure of an organization, and those who hold power, and I as abbot can attest to that. That as we have been exploring this and examining this over the years from different ways, there have been many, many moments where that has felt threatening. And sometimes it's to my own grasping at my role, right? As I try and evolve into that role forever, because that never ends, but also sometimes into the responsibility, which is in my mind, but has a manifestation of my role. And sometimes the threat seems to be to that, to what I feel like I am charged to be responsible for. That too has to evolve. That very sense of what my responsibility is. It has to become more complex, more larger. And within that, that's happening within certain conditions, always, always, always. And some of those conditions is 2,500 years of practice, of teaching, of ancestors, of human beings, their own systems, working within their own times, doing the same thing in their own way. Being disrupted, experimenting, wanting to maintain that light, that lamp that has passed down generation to generation, and to more and more skillfully meet the demands, not just the needs, but the demands of this time, of their time. And so I think it's fascinating to explore this from this way of understanding. A biologist said, evolution appears not to be a series of accidents, the course of which is determined only by the change of environments during history and our resulting struggle for existence. But evolution is governed by definite laws, and the discovery of these laws constitute one of the most important tasks of the future, meaning now. The discovery of the laws by which we exist, live, interact, evolve, respond. And to think of that, that we're not just living within the immutable laws of karma, for instance, but the way systems work, whatever this, because these are laws that exist in this universe we live in. That's why these researchers are looking at all different, it's biological, it's environmental, it's governmental, it's policy. They're looking at anywhere they look, they're finding the same laws in place, in play. And if we look at that from our own perspective, I think it can give us insight, both in terms of just our own individual or personal practice, to speak of it that way, but also in terms of what are we doing? What is actually happening here? And how do we self-organize in a way that helps us to fulfill our vows? Because within every system, as it's understood, there is a purpose. And that as systems become more complex, in a sense, those greater complexity, complex systems hold a greater and greater sense of the purpose. So in a sense, you know, when we first enter into training, our purpose is to practice. It's to train, it's to learn how to do this, it's to learn how do we function within the Sangha. And then within other systems that have more complexity, right? Like the monastics, Chikai students, Guardian Council, Board of Directors, senior students, these different bodies, these systems, have their own increased levels of complexity. And that is a fact. Because each of them is dealing with more and more systems that are nested within it. Which means their responsibility is greater, but also the movement is greater. But it doesn't mean, what it does not mean, is that any individual, any aspect within any system nested together is inherently more important or less important, greater or lesser. That's what we do with our mind. They are all nested together because they're all essential to the whole. You know, part of the learning, I think, the way I think of it is to use everything available to learn, everything available to help, and use the wisdom that comes from other fields, whether that's other sanghas, other Buddhist traditions, other teachings, other practices, whether it means other fields of study. And maybe if we do that, if we were all doing that more and more, we would realize more and more that quality of being, we're actually all nested together. Because each of these, in a sense, paths of study keep reaffirming, if they're encountering anything that's true, they keep affirming what everybody else is doing, what everybody else is discovering. And maybe that would help us to realize we're actually in this together. So I want to end with a poem by Li Yong Li, one of my favorite poets, who, in a way that I think pertains to what I've been speaking of, but brings a little bit of life. It's called From Blossoms. From blossoms comes this brown paper bag of peaches we bought from the boy at the bend in the road where we turned toward signs painted peaches. From laden boughs, from hands, from sweet fellowship in the bins, comes nectar at the roadside, succulent peaches we devour, dusty skin and all, comes the familiar dust of summer, dust we eat. Oh, to take what we love inside, to carry within us an orchard, to eat not only the skin, but the shade, not only the sugar, but the days, to hold the fruit in our hands, adore it, then bite into the round jubilance of peach. There are days we live as if death were nowhere in the background. From joy to joy to joy, from wing to wing, from blossom to blossom, to impossible blossom, to sweet, impossible blossom.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.